Shango, moju ba.
That people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are.
This Most call is being recorded.
History tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers, on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Apologize for being black. All I am plus all I lack. Please, sir, please, ma'am, give me some slack, because I apologize. I apologize for being poor, for being sick and tired and so. Since I ain't slick, don't know the scope, I do apologize. I apologize because I bear resemblance most black people share. Thick lips, flat nose, and nappy hair. Yes, I apologize. I apologize for how I look, for all the lows and blows I took on those Lord knows I'd close. close the book as I apologize. I apologize for all I gave, for letting you make me your slave and go into my early grave. Yes, I apologize. I apologize for being caught, for being sold, for being bought, while being told I count for naught. Yeah, I apologize. I apologize for all I've done, for all my toil out in the sun. Don't want to spoil your righteous fun, so I apologize. I apologize and curse my kind for being fooled, for being blind, for being ruled and in your bind. Yes, I apologize. I apologize and curse my fate for being slow, for being late, because I know it's me you hate. Why not apologize? I apologize and tip my hat, because you so rich and free and fat. Son of a bitch, that's where it's at. And I apologize.
Thank you. Hotep, my brothers and sisters, welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, Dr. William Rogers. So well, a pleasure and an honor to be with you here this evening. The Black Reality Think Tank is here every Tuesday from 8 p.m. Eastern Time to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, 7 p.m. Central to 9 p.m. Central. And so we are so happy that you have joined us this evening. We have a very dynamic discussion on classical Mother Africa. And so we are going to be getting into our subject matter very shortly. But as usual, we always like to begin our program by simply, first of all, thanking you and giving praises to our ancestors whose shoulders that we stand upon. I hope all of you have had a very productive week, a very good week. We are broadcasting from our studios here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We'll be broadcasting again very shortly from Atlanta, Georgia, but right now we are in the Carolinas. I'm sorry, not the Carolinas, but we are in Wisconsin broadcasting for today. And as I said earlier, we're going to talk about Mother Africa, and we're going to talk about some historical factors that make that discussion necessary. And we'll explain that to you very shortly. We are going to be joined in a few minutes from one of our co-hosts who comes on periodically and co-hosts the program with us. So we will await her entry, and we will then bring her on and have her discuss. Meantime, one of the things that we'd like to do is give praises to our ancestors. We do what we call our ancestral profile, and we highlight an individual who we think that is relevant to our topic. And so tonight, our host is a brother from the Harlem Renaissance, who was a very powerful poet that wrote often about Mother Africa and understanding our heritage from which he came. His name is Honor Bontemps. Honor Bontemps. Hoping for a much better life outside of the racially oppressive South, at his hometown of Alexandria, Louisiana, where Otto Wendell Bontemps was born on October the 13th, 1902. He was born into a middle-class Bontemps family, as his biographer has said. He moved to the Watts community just south of Los Angeles, California. They soon abandoned Catholicism and became devout Seventh-day Adventists. Honor Bontemps' mother was a school teacher, and his father was a bricklayer who was determined to have the family assimilate into the dominant white culture. In 1923, Bontemps graduated from Pacific Union College, which was a Seventh-day Adventist school in California, and he found work in the U.S. Post Office. He used his church connections to secure a teaching job at the Harlem Academy in New York City in 1924. Bontemps' arrival in the metropolis coincided with the height of the Harlem Renaissance, and inspired by the creative energy that surrounded him and encouraged by his associates. Over the next 3 years, he wrote poetry that, where he was able to receive the Alexander Pushkin Prize from Opportunity Magazine, which is a magazine of the National Urban League, and a poetry prize from the Crisis Magazine, which was a publication of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. He was married in 1926 to a former student. Bontemps published his first novel, God Sends Sunday, in 1931. It was a racy tale of a jockey's hectic life based on some of the true experiences of his Uncle Buddy, which was followed by the award-winning A Summer Tragedy in 1932. A broadly anthologized, unsentimental short story concerning an elderly, married Mississippi Delta sharecroppers who commit suicide. During this period, he forged lasting friendships with people like Langston Hughes, County Cullen, and others. And eventually, the Great Depression dispersed talented Harlemites like Bontemps, who returned to the South to teach in the early 1930s at Oakwood Junior College, which was another Seventh-day Adventist school. He was considered a pioneer among the African-American historical fiction writers. Bontemps authored the best known of his novels, which was the critically acclaimed Black Thunder in 1936, which was based on the actual event of a slave revolt in Virginia led by Gabriel Prosser in 1800. Bontemps was largely responsible for bringing to prominence the genre of African-American children's literature with Popo and Fifina, Children of Haiti, and subsequent works of this nature. In 1938, he penned his final novel, Drums at Dusk. It created disappointing sales, and mixed reviews of the novel persuaded him to concentrate even more on literature for young readers until the 1960s, when he published Personals in 1965, which was a collection of poetry, and he wrote the introduction to paperback edition of Black Thunder in 1968. Upon earning his master's degree in library science at the University of Chicago in 1943, Arnold Bontemps began 21 years of a distinguished service at Fisk University, where he was professor and head librarian. The Broadway musical St. Louis Woman, based on his first novel, premiered in 1946, and he collaborated with Langston Hughes to publish The Poetry of the Negro in 1940. In the decades of the 1950s, Arnold Bontemps wrote biographies aimed at young people. He teamed up again with Langston Hughes to co-edit The Book of Negro Folklore in 1950. In the late 1960s, he taught at the University of Illinois at Chicago Circle briefly, and he was the curator of the James Weldon Johnson Collection at the Beinbeck Library at Yale University. Arnold Bontemps was a member of Sigma Phi fraternity, and his final book was called The Harlem Renaissance Remembered, which he wrote in 1972. Among his honors and awards were two Julius Rosenwald Fellowships and two Guggenheim Fellowships. He also was recipient of the James Adams Children's Book Award in 1956 for The Story of the Negro in 1948, and an honorary doctorate from Morgan State University and Berea College. While a writer in residence at Fisk collecting his short fiction for publication, he died at his home in Nashville, Tennessee on June 4, 1973. He was 70 years of age at the time of his death. Honor, Bontemps. Okay, very powerful brother. Harlem Renaissance is a very powerful period in time in African history, African-American history. At some point in time here at the Black Reality Think Tank, we would like to maybe have a discussion on the Harlem Renaissance and some of its impact today. We are so happy to be a part of this network. We are part of a network called the TimeForAnAwakening.com. TimeForAnAwakening.com network, which is also a part of the Black Talk Radio Network. And I am so very proud to say that the Black Talk Radio Network is the number one podcast network for African Americans in the nation. Well, actually, it's international. It's an international award. And so we're proud to be a part of that and to get an opportunity to broadcast to so many areas of the world. We are international, as you know, because this is internet radio. And so we are able to reach folk in places like Berlin, England, Africa. We also have one brother that, it's actually one sister that writes to us from Fiji, Japan. And she's also in the military, but she listens to the Black Talk Radio system very well. So we're happy to use this medium and spread the word, and we hopefully will continue to do so. My co-host hasn't joined me yet, but in a way, we will go on because we have to do so as we move forward. We do have some of my friends online right now, and I'm so happy to know that they are here, but we'll be coming to you soon, very shortly, and we want to obviously have you engage into this discussion tonight. We're talking about classical African civilization, classical African indigenous civilization. long before the Asiatic or European invasion. And we want to highlight and pull out some key points, and there's a reason for that. Recently, I have been working with a group here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, who is working on a project that consists of several things. They want to, first of all, create a think tank where they can look at issues and ideas and things facing the African-American community in Milwaukee, and then be able to make decisions to key figures or those who are in charge, educators, political figures, clerical figures, religious and spiritual systems, to talk about what some of the solutions to those problems might be. And so in order to do that, they want to also create, along with that, an elders council, and where the elders council will guide a lot of the activity and things that will be done, you know, along the lines of the think tank. And one of the things that is going to govern that process is that the think tank, as well as the Council of Elders, is going to be guided by the principles of Ma'at and the Nguzo Saba. And so what we have been doing is structuring a philosophical base so that we can present a strong and solid foundation to hopefully work. And one of the things that's necessary in that, as you know, the Nguzo Saba system is something that was a part of Dr. Marlena Coringa's work. The Ma'at system is a part of the civilization of Kemet. And so all of those incorporated together, as I said, will govern that. Well, one of the things that would be necessary then is obviously to look at the Dr. Coringa's theory of Kawaida. And the Kawaida theory, which is a Kiswahili word meaning liberation, is to understand how that philosophy will embrace what we're doing and embrace at the same time the African-American community. And so in order to do that, according to Dr. Coringa's theory, which is a part of our discussion, in order to have a solid Kawaida principle working, the African people here in this country must develop an ethos, E-T-H-O-S, an ethos of ourselves. And basically, according to him and according to the Kawaida theory, an ethos is the sum of characteristics and achievements of people which define and distinguish it from others and gives its collective self-conscious and collective personality. And that comes directly from Dr. Coringa's writings. And so he says, to put it another way, the ethos of a people is often called its national or ethnic character, which is not only defined by itself, but also assumed by others. Now, in order for an ethos to be developed, or a people's self-consciousness and self-definition, it is defined by their thoughts and their practices and the other six fundamental areas of culture, such as history, religion, social organization, economic organization, political organization, and creative production. This means essentially that we know ourselves and are known by what we have done and do, not by what others have said we have done and do, but what we say. And from our knowledge of self and others' knowledge or perception of us, we acquire our self-concept. And so that's the contribution of Africans, of places like Kemet, to the establishment of major disciplines of human knowledge defines them. And it defines them in their own eyes as well as the world's. African systems like the Moors, the Moorish culture, has also, and its interaction with Europe, and the African civilization of the Olmec, and African contributions to the social and cultural wealth of the U.S., and its political liberation and development all indicate sources of positive self-consciousness and self-definitions. So we have to look at the history of ourselves and determine what that is from our own definition, not somebody else's definition. Too much of our history had been written by others, and they made interpretations and analysis based on their understanding and reading it. We have to do that ourselves. And so for a very long time, we have not been able to assess and analyze the history of the classical Africa from our own perspective. We have used it from what others have said. And much of that sometimes was very negative. And so in the Kawa-Eater theory, self-realization has a double meaning. It means to know and to produce oneself. It means to know and to produce oneself. Now, in order to know yourself, that means it is to grasp the essence of your past. It's to go back and grab it and understand what it is. And then one's presence, and especially one's future possibilities, and thereby know who you are by what you have done, and thus what you are capable of doing and becoming based on past achievements and current conditions. That is how your ethos is developed. And so tonight I wanted us to take a look at ancient Africa, which has often been done, and often has not been done in this manner, from what we have said about so. Now, I had on our Facebook page, which is the Black Reality Think Tank, this week we have placed a map of the classical African indigenous civilizations before Asiatic or European invasions. These were a list of the countries and what the people who inhabited them believed they were and what they called them, not what Europe, the Greeks, the Romans, and all of them called them, but what the Africans called these. And I did so because if we were going, as we began the study of this nature, and it's a very in-depth and vast kind of study, and very clearly tonight we cannot clearly cover any all of this. I'm just looking more at the technique of it than I am in trying to cover it in its entirety and with the depth that I think that is necessary. But for one who is a student of history and who would wish to do that, this map is a beginning step. This is what you need to start the process. Because this map was done basically almost about, I did have a date for it. Let me just, it starts around 200,000 BCE, which is before the Common Era. So 200,000 years before the Common Era. And it goes all the way up to 350 before the Common Era. And then after that, when you begin to see the influx of Rome and Greece, those names began to change because they interpreted, obviously, in the language of the Greco-Roman rulership and power. But if you look at this map, and I would love for you all to take a look at it at some point if you haven't done so, photocopy it, pull down a copy of it and use it as your study. You will find the same names and countries as you see on a regular map, but in the language of the African people. And one would use this in a way that you could go and take that name and follow its etymological trail of how that name was developed and look at the interaction that particular country encountered in ancient civilization and how powerful they were and what they did and what their involvement was. To give you an example, the country of Ghana, which we know as Ghana, it wasn't called that among the inhabitants of ancient classical civilization. It was called Ouagadougou Mandé. And if you can track that history as Ouagadougou Mandé and discover what that was like, and that's ancient Ghana, and what their behavior was and their activity were, you would then clearly begin to understand, have a lot clearer picture of the Ghanaian people. There's another country, the Akan, which that name is also, you hear that even still today, but that there was an area, a specific geographical location called the Akan. And then one of the more interesting pieces on the map is a geographical area called Twa, the T-W-A, the Twa people. Very, very interesting history. And like I said, we don't have time to go into each one of these geographical locations and identify them because it's just too much. But there's a lot of history and theory about who the Twa were. Many historians argue they were the original people of the planet Earth, were the Twa. They were small in stature, around anywhere from 4 to 5 feet tall. They were also powerful travelers and navigators. They knew how to navigate the water and the oceans, according to some of the stories that was told about the Twa. And even there is one incident where the Twa migrated north and ended up in Ireland. Now, again, you have to track the history. I'm not saying that that's a fact, but I'm just telling you what literature is out there and what it said about the Twa people, and that these were the individuals that inhabited Ireland. And according to one theory, these are the individuals that St. Patrick was sent in to take out of Africa, take out of Ireland, and to begin to turn Ireland back to a Eurocentric culture and idea. And a lot of the spiritual, early spiritual systems are basically, according to some theories, derivatives of the Twa culture. The use, for instance, of where you see, where we known in history, where people have magic wands, and they at the tip of the magic wand is a five star, and the whole concept of five stars. It has been said that the Twa people were a part of that. So anyway, if you were to do a research, you would go in and take a look at the Twa people, track their name, look at their history. There is material on them. One of the things I'm going to give you a log out discussion today is I'm going to give you some resources that kind of identify some of the classical African civilizations for those who are interested in self-study. There's another kingdom, very interesting as well, with an interesting past, and I'm not going to go through all of them, I'm just going to give you some of them, is called Punt. And Punt is controversial because early historians indicated that Punt was near Kemet, is that it was in the northern part of the globe, and it was near Kemet. Where actually there are some that said no, it was in the southern. It was sub-equatorial geography, and that it was below the equator. And so on the map that I have placed on the Black Reality Think Tank webpage, Punt is located in the equatorial, southern equatorial region of Africa. Now there's a reason for that, according to some theories, is that the historians who argued that Punt was near Kemet were trying to make the point that most of civilization and people that were organized and were proficient in the use of tools and being able to farm and do those kinds of things were north of the equator, because anything south of the equator, because of its heat, they would be unproductive and backward cultures. And they would not be proficient in terms of a food, clothing, shelter, and obviously being able to master tools and agriculture and things like that. And very clearly, Punt was an extremely advanced empire out of the classic Africa. And so there was an attempt to take Punt out of that region and place it closer to the northern region. But the argument is stronger in terms of Punt being sub-equatorial Africa and where it's located. But when you go to the map, you'll see that's some of the challenges about the African history. I think one of the things we have to consider is we have to consider the system of cartology and the whole idea of map making. Number one, according to history and according to a lot of the writings, people who were inhabitants of this region at the time were not looking at it from a continental perspective. That had not come into format as a way of looking at lands and stuff, is that you had seven continents and that you got five oceans and you got these seas. That wasn't the case. So if somebody was from Trois, as far as the Trois people were concerned, that was their continent. That was their land. All the other folks were people from other areas. It wasn't looked at as Africa. They didn't call it Africa in that ancient classical world. It's just so happens that these lands were all lumped together on this one piece of land, and that it was surrounded by bodies of water, and very clearly that a lot of these bodies of water, were the ways that it was separated. But when those cartographers began to map, and the early mapping of the world really is a modern system, in terms of drawing maps. Now, however, people did do maps in ancient times. The Dogons definitely were master cartographers. The Dogons were those people that were in that West African community that right under Ghana. And Mali, the Malians were Dogons. And the Dogons, not only did the Dogons map the land, they mapped the universe, they mapped the stars. And they say that they were able to master that because of the fact that so above, so below. If you map above, it's easy to map below and vice versa. And so as a result of that, they were able to do that. But they were mapping for local movement and local travel. And then they also travel because of commerce. Commerce forces you to travel, and you need to be able to do that. So anyway, the map-making part, however, doesn't come into operation until about 1400, where they begin to map Africa. And one of the first maps of Africa, and I did some research for this, was looked at some of the ancient maps. And one of the first ancient maps of Africa was around 1508, and it was done by a European. And obviously, the map was missing North Africa. If you take it, I'm going to post that map on the website very soon. I have a copy of it. There is no Kemet on this first African map. It's in actually what was called Asia. It's taken out of the that region, and when you look at a map today and you see the Red Sea, well, the way this map is designed, the Red Sea ends at the top of what we call today Kush, which is, the Ethiopian people. So Kush, the Sudan area, is where the Red Sea ends, and everything above the Red Sea is in what became mapped of Europe. Well, this is all European stuff. They're the ones, the cartographers, that created that type of system. And so Africa is missing that. And then one of the other problems is the reference point of the size of that continent. And one of the things that later science did find out is that obviously Africa, this particular land mass that had all of these countries, is the second largest land mass on the planet. But it was perceived and drawn by early Europeans to be much, much smaller. If you look at a map that was done in the 1800s by a German cartologist named Mercator, Mercator has Africa small enough to be, is actually smaller than Greenland. Greenland is huge. If you look at an old Mercator map, Greenland is huge. Africa is about half of that size. Everything else, is, particularly the Euro world, is very large. And that type of referencing is a way of being able to have a perspective of who you are as being greater than everybody else. And that's what some of that was. And then it would not happen until a little later, another cartographer would come in called Peters, and we would get a copy of the Peters map, which would put Africa in the perspective in which it be, because you can actually take Greenland, America, and Europe, and put it in Africa about four or five times. And that's the way it's done. But anyway, that map making, again, is a reference point, a perspective of what others had about Africa and obviously its role and its coverage. So in our search to go back in history, as we develop from the Kawaita experience, as we develop an image of self and to produce ourselves, to create ourselves, and do some of the things we do, we would put that history in much better perspective. Dr. Karinga goes on to say that in order to produce oneself is to create oneself through struggle against natural and social oppositions. The transatlantic slave trade and some of those horrible systems that Africans endured, particularly as they came to the world, is a reality we have to face. But what we take out of that reality is the fact that we survived it, that we are a people of survival, that we were able to still produce, we were able to still build a greatness, you know, even though we had encountered such harsh opposition. So our knowledge of ourselves is that we know that we are capable of surviving. And so your ethos is that you are a survivor. That's a major part of it. That's a major part of what we take away to our children. And so as we begin to recreate ourselves and recreate ourselves to our children, that is what we have to tell them. We are survivors. We have come a mighty long way, as the saying goes. For as a people struggles, you know, to overcome basic oppositions, then what that does, it creates and defines itself, and it informs the world of its differences and distinctiveness. The people, you know, come into being and knows about itself and about its achievements and through its efforts to become and know itself that it achieves. Given this fact, it is a fundamental Kawaita contention that people whose achievements are minor or whose knowledge of its history and the possibility it suggests is a deficient culture. That's why very clearly you hear so many times that we have to know ourselves. And moreover, in a social context which defines and deforms a people's capacity to realize themselves, and the whole problem of self-consciousness is not simply a problem of thought, but is a problem of practice. We have to begin to practice greatness. Not only just think about being great, practice it, live it, live your life as you are great. For the demand to end this sort of deficient consciousness of not knowing who you are, it must be a demand to eliminate the conditions which caused it. One of our listeners last week, we talked about it, survival and can we survive? And he raised a very good point. My brother Herbie White raised a very good point. And he said, you can do all the things you want to do and build what you want to build. But unless you get rid of white racism and white supremacy concepts and ideas and public policies, you're going to get the same thing that you've always had. And so, and that's a very good point. So you have to end not only the deficient consciousness, but you have to eliminate the conditions which caused it. That's where your work comes in. And so some of the disciplines that, you know, we have, the schools of black psychology, the schools of sociology, and so forth, or have attempted to come up with these theories and ideas. So in terms of the Kawaita process, in terms of the ethos that we are trying to develop, the problem of self-consciousness is solved in the process of solving the social problems as I said, which caused it. This essentially means, this is how we do it. This is what we do. This essentially means that through study, like what we're doing tonight, work and struggle, building and becoming, you can begin to reveal our real self and some of those hidden areas and layers of false roles and identities that are imposed on us by the dominant society. They'll begin to emerge now with us bringing that greatness. And that's what the Kawaita, the Nguzo Saba, and some of those other schools of thought have attempted to do. They have attempted to do that. We have been celebrating the whole Kwanzaa idea, which is a celebration of the Nguzo Saba theory, which the Nguzo Saba theory is a connect of the Kawaita theory. We've been celebrating to kind of get people to use it and to use it in conjunction with the Ma'at and how the Ma'at system will operate. And we have to begin to understand what the Ma'at will do and how it does work. But it has been a struggle because of the facts of some of the things that we do and we're guilty of. So through self-conscious efforts and the resultant achievements in the various areas of human thought and practice, as well as the model of work and liberational struggle, the Africans, we as Africans living in America, we must begin to transform ourselves into a distinct, self-realized, and self-conscious historical personality. We must be proud of our past, we must be challenged by the present, and we must be inspired by the possibilities of the future. And that's what we have to tell our children. We must have to create our own institutions. That's why it saddens me so much sometimes to see some of the institutions that we've created begin to fall. Not that it was one of the best examples of that, but things like Essence, Ebony Magazine. Ebony had some problems and issues, but still, it did put on the table that Africans had achieved. In some ways. And so a lot of times Ebony would highlight that greatness, give us a chance to understand the history and news of ourselves that we didn't get before. And so we have to begin to go back to that. So that is the reason why we want to talk a little bit tonight about these historical points of classical African civilization and see if we can garner from them some just key points that we can begin to work with and develop better selves and put that into operation. Most of the history of black people, African people, humans, and civilization, as we all know, began in Africa. That's the bottom line. I think there's nobody that doesn't agree to that. What they might disagree upon is how it matured, how it developed. But nevertheless, we know that that's a hiss. So there are three major factors that have combined to sort of obscure this fact, which makes our study in African history necessary, because there are some things that have come into play and that have created some challenges. First of all, it's a vast history. It's just vast, and it is very complicated. And it has created a flux, and it has been very confusing. There have been incidents where, for instance, when I was reading the whole area of ancient Ghana, there were historians that were saying that the original habitants of ancient Ghana were whites, and their picture were whites, and they have placed that in publications and images, because one of the things that the Euro world did in its desire to dominate and control is that it not only took over resources and land and things like that, but it created dominated the intellectual knowledge. And they did that by writing their own books, putting together their own publications and material, and then making it seem as though it was fact. And so they said the ancient Ghanaians were Caucasians, and they were Caucasian-looking people. And they have placed it in their books and printed it that way. And nobody has challenged that, you know, until lately. And they have challenged it in a way that we know that that is not true. So our study and our approach to studying history has to begin to take place in that manner. African civilization, and we've had some fabulous historians that have told us the real deal. Dr. Chancellor Williams, Dr. John Jackson, have all told us of what the greatness of African life was like, and also helping us to understand its complexity and why it has had so many challenges. And so very clearly, when you start getting into what color and all of that, you must remember that the ancient world didn't see color in terms of how they ruled the world. You know, it's just a biological, geographical position. Where the equator is, and in that region of the world, is extremely hot. And so obviously anyone that is in that area must have some form of pigmentation. There's a chemical in the body called melanin that provides the pigmentation to block the sun rays from killing you. And so that, which is another whole story of the role and process of melanin and how it plays. But that's one of the best ways if when people want to start getting into that color thing and looking at what color this or this group was that color, you need to look at the melanin. And that's what Dr. Sheikh Antazope did in his work. He went into the tombs of the mummies and looked at how much of the melanin content was there, so that he could shut the European world up about talking that Egypt, at the time what it was called Egypt, but Kemet was a white world. It was a Euro world, and it was not a part of Africa. And so that helps to straighten a lot of that out. But it's scholars like that that are not around anymore. We need to develop a new school of thought, scholars, so they can develop who we are, that we and continue our greatness. The second thing that you have to look at is that the study of African history is complicated by the predominance of oral history. Oral history was a tradition in Africa, in many places, as the most definitive African perspective on the subject. And now that is not to say that Africans did not have scripts as well. There were several very powerful ancient scripts that were available with stories of the development of African people and African countries. So on the contrary, as I said, there were many scripts. Obviously, we know of the hieroglyphics of Kemet. We hear of the hieratic and the demotic scripts that came out of the Kemetic system, the Meriadic scripts that also were around, the Coptic scripts that were more toward the East Africa, the areas of Nubia and Kush, the Amharic, the Sabine, and the Ge'ez scripts of Ethiopia, or Kush, as it was called then, were available, the Berber and the Carthaginian scripts of North Africa, and then the Arabic scripts of the North, Northeastern and Western Africa. These were all language systems that were telling our history. And the key to understanding that, obviously, is being able to interpret. Being able to interpret it in a way that you can, being able to interpret it in a way that you can use it and find out and decipher, you know, the life of that area. And so this long list of scripts that I'm just talking about clearly exceeds the two main scripts of Europe, Greek and Roman. The Greco-Roman scripts were shadows in the light of these the ones that I just talked about. And so the key would be someone who can go in and take a look at that. Moreover, the European and the Arab conquest also led to a lot of destruction. As the Arab world began to move into Africa, it changed religious orientations and so forth, and it created a lot of destruction of going into the library of Alexandria and destroying all of the texts and ancient books in those scripts, going into the ancient scrolls of Mali and the Malian people of the Dogon history and all the things that the Dogons had written, and destroying that and burning all of that history so that they could dominate. All of that has created some real challenges, you know, obviously for the African world that doesn't allow that. So we still, though, have historians, and we have historians that have been able to sort of go in and garner texts and interpret a lot of these readings and writings. And I'll have to say, you have to be honest, a lot of them were Europeans who were able to do that because they had the ability to gain access. So they could get into some of those ancient archives of the world and begin to do that. So what Dr. G.M. James and Dr. Jobe, Dr. John Jackson, these were folk that we have to treasure in our terms of our history, and that's how it has been able to be passed down to them. Chancellor Williams even went so far as to track how the great kingdoms fell. And so that is the way, again, that we have to go back into that history and keep that going. It has diminished somewhat. Very clearly, it's not offered in public education. It's not even offered in university education anymore. Very rarely do you get universities that teach that. There are a few. Howard University does. They have still a very strong African history department. They keep that moving. The University of Wisconsin-Madison has a good history department. And they have looked at mostly modern age Africa. Very clearly, they don't go to the ancient African system of thought. But then, and as I said, there are some European historians that have done a fabulous job. Basil Davidson, for instance, is one. And the books that he does has looked at and written about Africa. And he wrote a book called Mother Africa. And he's done a fantastic job. And he's an Oxford University historian scholar. And Basil Davidson, I applaud him very well. And then Martin Bernal is another European historian that has done fabulous work in looking at the African histories too. Again, they've been able to gain access. And see, that's the key. You got to have access to these libraries. And a lot of times it is screened from us. I was talking to a good friend over the weekend, and we were both saying, if you could get the keys to the Vatican vault, you would find some stuff in there that would probably just make you pass out because there is so much powerful material that has been stolen and harnessed in the Vatican vault, in the vaults of England. England has done a major job, stolen all these artifacts and treasures of Africa to the point where it makes it look like they have nothing. And their museums and libraries have all of that stuff where in their conquering and conquest, they were able to take, you know, all of those things. So I'm going to bring our host. Our host is our co-host. I thought the co-host was on. Now she's gone again. Okay, the idea of this process that I'm talking about, and that's really what we're talking about tonight, the process of getting this information and using it in a way that we can continue to define ourselves from ourselves. That is what the Kwanzaa celebration was about. That is what the Nguzo Saba was about, is to give that. But you got to go back and you got to do some work. You can't wait for somebody to write something and hand you a piece of paper and then you say, oh, yeah, this is it. We got to do it ourselves, and some of it. A lot of us have the skills to do it. Others have the desire to do it. Some of us don't. But then those that don't have it, you know, we then have to present it to our people in a way that it will be of interest. We have to present it to our children and teaching them to understand. Wisconsin, for instance, in Milwaukee, there was an African immersion elementary school, and there was an African immersion middle school. Middle school was called Malcolm X Academy, and the elementary school. It's called Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. School. And I had the pleasure of working in the elementary school, working with the staff. Many of the teachers who were teaching there did not have the knowledge and the background to study African history. It was there, but they just didn't have the knowledge to do it. And they didn't know it. They didn't know the principles of Kwanzaa. They didn't know what that meant, even though it was in their curriculum to use with their students. They had to learn it first. They had not learned that particular system. And so as a result, it was my job to go in and to help them infuse that the African teachings into the regular school curriculum and into the regular school ideas. And it was great. They were open. That was the key. They did desire to learn it. And there were some wonderful opportunities that were developed out of that. And that's the kind of thing that you have to continue to do. And you have to use this process that I'm talking about. You can't start with the modern era. You got to go back to classical Africa. You got to take that map that I explained that's on my Black Reality Think Tank website on Facebook, that classical African indigenous civilization map. Go in there and take it and start from there. That's your beginning process. You got to go in there and look at Kush and see what that was. There's a country called Medjay, M-E-D-J-Y, which is basically Somalia. Go see what that was and what happened and where that came from and how that was started. Go look at Punt. Go look at Luba Bemba, which is a southern African region. Go look at Himba, Sand. These are African indigenous names of these nations that we've known over time. There's a country right in the center, which would probably be today the Congo area. It's called Sahara. Go look at Sahara and what that comes from. Look at Dak, Ife, and Hausa culture. These are the original geographical names of areas that compromised this landmass that eventually became known as Africa. And I said, and a core study to this is you have to look at the geography as well and the creation of geography, cartography, how it began, who did it. One of the most valuable parts of looking at it from that perspective, you got to remember, for a long time, early cartographers said that the world was flat. And so therefore, any map design would have to be based on a flat world system. And not only was that system ideologically in place, it was a spiritual piece. And you could be killed by the church if you tried to practice or promote the idea of a round world. And some of the Europeans who did promote that, people like Copernicus. Copernicus was a philosopher that believed that the world was round. He said it wasn't flat. And as a result, he designed round world maps. Most of the European cartographers came out of southern Italy. They were down in the Naples area. That's where most of your maps of Europe were done. And so when Isabella Ferdinand grabbed Columbus, they grabbed him out of Italy because he was a part of that map group. But he was also a round world explorer. There were flat map explorers, and then there were round world explorers. And many people believed that the world was round, but it would have been against the philosophy and teachings of the Catholic Church at the time. And obviously, if they did that, they would be killed, because Copernicus was arrested many times, threatened to be killed, and so forth, because of his ideology about round world. Okay, I want to look at East Africa for just a minute, because that's a very important area of the globe in terms of looking at how that's developed, and the reason why. It has a lot to do with the formation of of regions outside of what the maps say was Africa, called Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia, Sumeria, and Babylon. And these are names that we pick up. We pick these up biblically, you know, when they start redoing the biblical story, because that's another whole history that you have to understand and look at how that was developed from the Judeo-Christian world. And the Judeo-Christian system is a development of Kemet and Kush and Nubia. These were developments of that, and as I said earlier, possibly even the Twa people. But it's passed into Europe coming out of the East African region. And as a case of that, that's where we began to see some of that ideology emerge. There's a book written by a guy named Carl Luckett, L-U-C-K-E-T-T. The book is called Egyptian Fire, Hebrew Light. Egyptian Fire, Hebrew Light. And what Luckett is, he's a European professor at the University of Missouri, and he is documenting that Christianity is a part of the Kemet religion system. Now, we know that, but obviously the religious world won't allow that to flow in that way, and they say that it comes out of the Judeo-Christian, the Hebraic culture, but that's totally not true. And even Babylon, where we see the Babylon, which today is Iraq, Persia, which very clearly is one of the first religions to see that, and Persian, the whole Persian system is real strange, because that's where we get a theory by the name of Zoroastrianism. And the philosophy of Zoroastrianism has a lot of the early theory of Christianity in it. And so we would have to look at that. And so what I'm doing is I'm giving you the study method of what needs to happen as we study classical ancient history. And so this is kind of the path that you take. So you would have to look at East Africa, and you'd have to look at how East Africa develops. And some of the powerful work is that looking at, you know, the Nile Valley civilization. Brother Anthony Browder has done a very powerful piece with that, along with others. And, you know, his work does spell a lot. John Jackson's work, as I indicated. These are giants in that field that you cannot get away from. And what we're talking about time-wise is you're talking about 8,000 BCE. When these great civilizations along that East African coast began to rise in power. A lot of Kemet comes out around that 8,000 BCE. Dr. Asa Hilliard has mapped time-wise a lot of that early development and sort of put a name to and a time to how it is. So you would need to follow that. He's got some great pieces that he's done on those early African civilizations. And you can go to Dr. Hilliard's, Asa Hilliard's website that he has, and Google that, and he has some of those charts that are available. But then you look at the Kingdom of Kush, which you're looking at around 900 to 270 BCE, before the Christian era. The Meroitic period, around 270 BCE, is in there. You'd have to definitely study that. There are some very powerful leaders coming out of Mero very clearly. The first one is King Kashta, spelled K-A-S-H-T-A. And he has a very powerful history as being one who was the conqueror of Egypt. And he is the founder of what was known as the 25th dynasty of Kemet. See, one of the problems that as Kemet was growing to be this powerful nation, one of the arguments among historians is who were the commission? Where did they come from? And that's where you begin to get all those weird stories about where the commission came from. But very clearly, our historians have documented they came out of the South. Depending on the orientation that you use, that would have been the North. They came out of the North, and they're the ones that settled Kemet, and they're the ones that created that powerful world that we know today. And so that is the resources that very clearly, you know, you would use to do that. Let me stop a minute and give you just a couple of resources that I think that you might want to take down. These are publications and books that have been written on all of that early ancient history. We're going to make available to our readers and listeners a very extensive bibliography. Actually, it's an annotated bibliography. It's a list of books along with a description of what they're about. And we're going to be doing that very soon. We're going to put it on our website, and you'll be able to access it for your own personal library, because, again, we're trying to pass this on. We're trying to help us define ourselves. There's a book that helps explain a lot of the history of Nubia. There's a book written by a man, by the name of William Adams. William Adams, and the name of the book is Nubia, Corridor to Africa. Nubia, Corridor to Africa. Book was published in 1977, and it's published by the Princeton University Press. There's another book by J.F.A. Ajayi, A-J-A-Y-I. I repeat, the last name is A-J, as in John, A-Y-I. It's just a tongue twister. Let me do it one more time. J-F-A is his initials of his first name. His last name is spelled A as in apple, J as in John, A as in apple, Y as in yarn, I as in N. Ajayi, J.F.A. Ajayi. And the name of the book is 1,000 Years of West African History. 1,000 Years of West African History. And that is I actually used some material from that book to talk about some of the things that we're doing now. And then there's another one, a very familiar brother that we all know, Dr. Yosef Ben Akana, wrote a book called Africa, Mother of Western Civilization. Africa, Mother of Western Civilization. That book was done in 1971. And then there's the European writer, and I will mention this because it does have, you know, some value. His name is Martin Bernal. Martin Bernal wrote a book called Black Athenia, The Afro-Asiatic Roots of Classical Civilization. It's a two-volume work. The volumes are sold separate. I did see somewhere recently they have combined both volumes into one. You can buy the book, both volumes included. But nevertheless, it's Martin Bernal, B-E-R-N-A-L. And the name of the book is Black Athenia, The Afro-Asiatic Roots of Classical Civilization. And that's a powerful piece to look at. And be able to understand some of those roots as well. And then there is a historian out of University of North Carolina, University of Wisconsin, Madison. And I have some problems with his work, but however, it's worthy of a look. His name is Philip Curtin. Philip Curtin wrote a book called African History. It's published in 1990, and it was based on a lot of more recent research, and that's one of the reasons why I recommend it and offer it forward to you, our listening audience. And then there's another European historian, the one that I also mentioned earlier, that I like his work. He has done a great job of trying to be objective in recording African history. His name is Basil Davidson. B-A-S-I-L Davidson, wrote a book called African Civilizations Revisited. And he did that in 1991. And then the daddy of African history himself, Sheikh Anta Diop, wrote a book called The African Origin of Civilization, Myth or Reality. And I'm sure a lot of you already have that book in your library. If not, you need it. Sheikh Anta Diop, The African Origin of Civilization. And then he wrote another book, Sheikh Anta Diop wrote another book called Civilization or Barbarism, an Authentic Anthropology. And he wrote that in 1991 as well. Powerful, broad. And then he wrote another book in 1978 called The Cultural Unity of Black Africa. The Cultural Unity of Black Africa. And those books are available. They're available to get. You might want to start off by trying a bookstore in Baltimore called Black Classic Press. It's owned by a brother named Coates. He is the father of Tehisi Coates, the scholar that many Europeans like to quote. But they have a bookstore in Baltimore, Maryland called the Black Classic Press, and they have redone a lot of those books. And then one of my main hero people that I love and have embraced all the time, Dr. W.B. Du Bois, wrote a book in 1965 called The World and Africa. The World and Africa. Clearly a book needed for your library. And to go along with that, Dr. Du Bois did a book in 1975 called Black Folk, Then and Now. Black Folk, Then and Now. These are classics. These are books that I'm giving to you that are classic. And then during my undergraduate years, these books were required for me as a history major. I had to read a book by J.D. Fage, F-A-G-E, called A History of West Africa. J.D. Fage, A History of West Africa. And I think it would be interesting to look at that and then, you know, do some comparing and contrasting your own personal writings. And then there's an edited version, and this is the last one I'll get. And hopefully I don't know whether Sister Yan is back on. I saw her on one time, and then she went off. Nope, she's not on again. Okay, so there is a book by Aura Naduri, N-A-D-O-U-R-Y. N-L is an E-L, is a Muslim title there. Aura is his first initial. L Naduri, N-A-D-O-U-R-Y. And I have looked at this book. It is really good. I know a couple of documentaries were done using this book as a guide. It's called The Legacy of the Pharaonic Egypt. The Legacy of Pharaonic Egypt. And it's found in a volume 2 of something called The General History of Africa, Ancient Civilizations of Africa. And so as a result of that, that book does help you do some connecting key figures. It's very clearly a wonderful guide for doing that. So those are some resources that I definitely would like to offer as we end this conversation. There's a couple of more things I want to do, but first I want to open up the line and give our audience a chance to talk, ask questions, give us your input on your research efforts, if you'd like to, and tell us what you have been able to learn from that some of us might be able to use in terms of our independent study. But this is going to help us continue to define ourselves as long as we know that. And that's why, you know, we're doing that today. So let me go over to my my good friend, Brother Timothy, as always. Always appreciate you, Brother Timothy, Philadelphia. Brother Timothy, what do you think have to say about African history and some of your research?
You know, Dr. Rogers, your ethereal plane in teaching put me on another level, almost put me to sleep.
I hope not.
But I'm going to say this, that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad died with a lot of information. Yeah. And I've heard him say in tape that he would never teach a man like he taught Malcolm X.
Right.
Because of what they went through. Unfortunately, that happened.
Yeah.
But Farrar gave him over 105 books to read. And of all you did, Dr. Rogers, you got an A+.
Thank you, sir.
And you left out one book, Gerald Massey.
Oh, yeah. Gerald Massey. Oh, yeah. I get him.
Gerald Massey.
Yep.
But you did everything right, without a doubt. And I'm going to say that I have a friend of mine I soldier with, Eric 2X. Sometime we get together. I got my stuff. He has his stuff. He has all the old Muhammad speech in the trunk.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Eric, whatever happens, you got to pass this stuff on, man, because we don't want to die and nobody gets it. But he has those old Muhammad speech. And they're so impressive to me, Dr. Rogers, because you have an African on one end of the paper holding an African-American on the other end. So you have the African holding the African-American's hand around the globe, showing you that we are connected. Now, in America, we enslave Africans. Over there, there are Africans in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the messenger taught us that the white man will tell you that your history is 50,000 years and 35,000 years. It goes back further than that. He wants to discredit you to what you know and where your people are from and what all you're supposed to take on. Now, you said something was very important. The messenger taught us that you have Upper and Lower Egypt. And he said that that type of thinking goes on today. He said there were certain parts of Egypt where people came from where they were the gods. The concept of God came from Africa. And he said that spirit was independent of matter.
Okay.
That's another conversation. That's another thing.
Indeed,
he said there were some folks of Africa who thought out on the outside of themselves. He said there was no mystery God to the ones who thought they were God. And he talked about the Dogon people. He said the Dogon people, he said that if you go into Metanature, what people call the hieroglyphs, you'll see them with apparatus that look like they were space travelers.
Right.
Nothing made up.
Right?
Nothing made up. He said, you know, people talk about flying in space and going first Sputnik, and then you had Armstrong went to the moon, and, you know, with the Apollo 12, and then she said, the African was doing that. He also said that he talked about the Bantwa, the Twi. He said those were small people. That's why the interest of the pyramids but only was so high. That's all of our knowledge, all that we built. He talked about Mansa Musa, Aski, and Muhammad.
Right.
How Mansa Musa traveled to and brought Mecca all that it needs for riches.
All the way from the West Coast.
Right. So you talk about the classical education of Africa. He said they want to distort that. And they don't even want to put Egypt in Africa. They want you to think Egypt is separate from Africa. See, and he said that he talked about Troy. He said Troy actually existed. And in Malcolm's X autobiography, there was a person who he talked about was called Homer. Malcolm said his real name was Omar.
Right.
He was a griot who told the history of what Troy was about. So, Dr. Rogers, you opened up. You need to do a series on this. I got so much of this in my head. You would just bring me, you were waking me up, man. And you know, I'm going to say this to you. I'm going to let somebody else a turn.
Mm-hmm.
The messenger also had a lesson on the yogis. I know what you said about yoga. See, I'm a martial artist, and I have to practice yoga because I have to stretch. He brings that into our prayer. But that's another conversation. But you did something that was classical. Listen to me, man. What you did was something that we need to do to let us know that we're not a primitive people. That's the whole idea. They want to take you off of your square, standing perpendicular from the ground. Because we are the people who built, created this planet. And he talked about the mythite theory. Okay, I'm going to come back on that because that mythite theory is what the Nation of Islam is built on because we don't believe in the mystery God.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to let that go and I'll come back.
Okay. All right. Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you so much. And that's a good point you raised about yoga. A lot of people think that that's a strict Asian system, but Africans clearly practice that, and it was a part of the spirituality that they use. And I know that there are some of our community activists who are using yoga as a means of working and healing and wellness, and they've been doing that in our community. And all of these things are part of that healing process that we have to get back to. We have to heal our people. Our people must be healed from those dark nights of slavery, that traumatic experience. And so these are things that do it. These are ways we do it. Our productive creation, our creative productive systems, you know, art and dance, and the various things that we do as we express ourselves in our history must be continued. Brother Pugh, how are you doing tonight in Baton Rouge? How are things for you?
Pretty good, Doctor.
Okay, good. Any thoughts on this African classical history?
Well, you know, the first thought is that it's way over my head. The only area where I think I might be able to make a contribution is you were talking about Dr. Karinga and his notion of ethos. Uh-huh. I have an ideal of what I call a black ethos and a white ethos.
Okay.
That I can share.
Please.
Yeah, if you're interested. Now the motivation was that at the end of the Haitian Revolution, the people were really opposed to the generals, to Dessalines and Christophe and these people, because they had a more elitist kind of, you know, theory of what Haiti ought to be. And one of the things that came out of that was this idea that they called some African people in Haiti, they called them Blancs. In other words, they called them whites. So anybody who internalized the French value system, they called them white. They didn't make a distinction between them and French people, right? Okay. And so what I want to suggest is that there is a black ethos, and there's a white ethos,
okay,
and that this black ethos, it tends to cover all, you know, all people with color in the world, and most white people. And then this white ethos only covers a very few few people. So let me just give the four elements of it, if you will, okay?
Uh-huh. Please.
Okay. All right. So the first problem that human beings have is how to live. You know, what's the strategy? In other words, I know personally that I'm going to die. Well, what should I do to live? And one thing, when we look at Kwame Nkrumah and his communalism, and you look at Ubuntu, this notion of I am because we are, what that suggests is that the black solution to the problem of life is biology. In other words, I'm going to live through the next generation.
Okay.
There's this circle of life, and that the way I'm going to live is that I'm going to produce children, and my children are going to produce children. And in fact, I remember Sister Ayan, I think she said, was it last week or the week before, she talked about somebody is going to live because their name is going to live, that she's personally going to, you know, repeat their name and so on. Well, you know, so that's one way you can live. You can live through biology. Now, the white way of living is through technology. That is to say, instead of me fighting death with life, which is the black way,
right,
I want to fight death with death.
Right.
That is, I want to figure out a way to kill things, you know, faster than they kill me. Well, the second dimension of this ethos that a human being will have is that once you identify your strategy for how to live on the planet, then the question becomes, what do you need to learn in order to implement that strategy? Now, the African people, you know, we use words like we call ourselves a rhythm nation and so on.
Right.
And so what the African people do is they say, well, oh, what I need to learn to live, you know, if I'm using the biological solution for survival, then what I need to learn are the rhythms of nature. That is, I need to learn ecology. Now, on the other hand, a white people who are interested in inventing some new technology, well, they don't need to learn the rhythms of nature. They need to learn, you know, different economic strategies because they want to impose their will upon nature. Right. But then that leads to the third dimension of an ethos. That is, we've already got the strategy that we're going to use to live. We've got what we need to learn in order to live. And now the question is, who do we need to love in order to live on the planet?
Exactly.
One of the things you do when you look at indigenous people, you'll always find that they have clan systems, that they consider themselves brothers to the turtle or brothers to the bear and so on.
Right.
And so the black ethos would basically say that if I want to learn how to live in harmony with nature, I can listen to my brother. I can watch, you know, other creatures, and they will tell me. On the other hand, the white ethos basically says that that if I want to learn how to live, I can't listen to any other creatures because they're inferior to me. That I really need to find that handful of rare individuals who are, you know, superior to everybody else, and they may help me go where no man has ever gone before.
Right.
And then the fourth dimension of, and this is the final dimension of the ethos, is that ultimately you know how you want to live, you know what you need to learn, you know who you need to love. Now the question is, well, how should you lead yourself? Should you be led by your heart or should you be led by your mind?
Okay.
Now,
good.
The African, I'm saying African and black, but I think it's better to say black because that's really a more general description. The black tradition is the golden rule. You know, you start talking about reaping what you sold and all that. This notion that there's that things are sort of circular. The white strategy basically says, you know, talks about randomness and that there are no real rules, there are no real limits, and that, you know, just, you know, get what you can get and whatnot. And so then those are the four dimensions the difference between
good.
A black ethos and a white ethos.
And I can see that. I can see that very clearly being why it's set up that way. As you obviously look at the world and look at how people run things around their world. You know, I do see. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. That adds right into it. Let me go over here to 414-573. Want to add to this conversation? 414-573.
Oh, good evening, Doc. I'm enjoying listening. I just finished class. I was taking a class in African spirituality, so I'm all here tonight.
Okay.
But I'm enjoying this topic, so thank you. It's very interesting. And you know, I practice yoga too, so I'm a yoga practitioner. So
right, I was going to ask you that. I want to ask you, how do you understand that yoga origin in terms of its African roots? Are you knowledgeable of that? And is it
Dr. Muta Asti has written a book, Egyptian Yoga, the Philosophy of Enlightenment.
Okay.
And so I usually start my class with that. And there is so much, there's such a huge connection that the students can, that they can view. And these things were written on the pyramids. I mean, and not the pyramids, but in the temples.
Right.
So just like we have the, you know, Hathor, they celebrate the cow goddess. Well, that was had different names in ancient Kemet and Egypt.
Right.
And so I show them the similarity of the philosophy, you know, and that's the most astounding part of yoga. I mean, the poses, yes, that's the hatha part, that's the active part. But then there's so many other parts that are involved with yoga, you know, the breath and the breathing, the meditation. Mm-hmm.
Okay, interesting, real interesting. Yeah, I must admit, I have a very limited knowledge of yoga and its usages, but I know that it works for a lot of people and that they have been doing it now, like yourself, you know, and I do want to learn more about that. But anyway, thank you. I've I know that it's an African system. I knew that.
It's an African system. They just don't want to, you know, as someone was saying, they just don't want, you know, to tell our roots. They don't want to disclose the truth. And so we have to get out there and do it. But it's fascinating. His book is fascinating. He's written about 3 or 4 different books. And, it's, you know, okay. And so that's what I started with. And then moving to, you know, in the Indus Valley, which, you know, became India.
Okay.
So,
great. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. Okay. Brother Herbie, how you doing tonight, Brother White?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Good evening, my brother.
Hotep, everybody else listening on the show.
Yes, right. Good.
And what I'm getting is that what we need to do is, in reading about ancient African civilizations, is how African people thought,
right,
how they felt about each other, how they viewed their world from an individual to the whole world.
Okay.
So you can understand how they thought and how they lived at that time. And if you can understand how they thought and how they felt about each other, their relationships,
right,
that you can start to do this with yourself today.
Yes, that's the point.
Because you may not need to build a pyramid today, but if you can understand the mentality of the people who built the pyramid, then you can build whatever you need to build today.
Right.
But it has to come from, if there was 20,000 people working on a pyramid, how did those 20,000 people get along with each other? How did they work together? How was there no animosity and no ego and stuff like that? What kind of people were these people?
Right.
And try to understand that. And you can understand, you can get around the chaos that we have today.
Yes. We're not able to work together. That's right.
Not being able to work together. You know, angry at your neighbor because they bought a new car. and all that kind
that's
of
true.
Stuff.
No, that's true.
You know?
It's true.
You know, so how did they deal with the materialism and all the other things? And if you can understand how these people, just on a day-to-day basis, what when they woke up in the morning, and what they did and why they did it.
Right.
And what they had in mind.
Right.
That they didn't wake up mad at their neighbor, mad at their job, mad at everything that they come in, mad because they don't have this or they don't have that. That singular thought.
Right.
That the world is all about me and whatnot. So if that's what I tried to do, try to understand what type of mentality went into building these great civilizations.
There we go. That's what I'm talking about. And it obviously has a spirit of the need to survive, and they understood that. And so you're right. And that's the essence of the study, to find that answer and come up with some answers like that. Okay, let me go over. I see a Newport News. I'm not sure if that's my good brother, Brother Griffin. Is that you, Brother Griffin, or is this someone? Newport News. Hello? I think you're breaking up real bad. You're breaking up real bad, caller. Caller, you're breaking up real bad. The Newport News caller, you're breaking up. We can't hear anything you're saying. No, you broke up. You're breaking up real bad. We can't hear you, so I don't know if you need to try another phone or whatever. I don't think I heard one word that you said. It's just breaking up real bad. And I definitely would like to hear from you to do that, but please try to see if you can correct that. Let me just do this. Let me try one more time. Can you hear me, caller?
Can you hear me, caller?
Yeah, we're not. I'm not hearing you. Yeah. I'm not hearing you at all. Okay. Is that you, Sister Young?
Yes, it is. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Greetings, Hotep. Peace and love.
Good. All right.
How you doing, Doc?
Doing great. How you doing?
All right. All right. Greetings to everyone else that's on the call. I just want to make a quick comment.
Okay.
So I was trying to listen earlier, Doc, and I couldn't hear you. Your volume sounds very low, so I had to wait until I got to a better phone where I could put it on speakerphone.
Okay.
So so I haven't heard, I didn't hear much, but I did hear Brother Pugh and whoever spoke after him, and both of those comments were excellent for me. And then I heard a little bit of what you were talking about earlier in terms of how Europeans are trying to rewrite history, and that made me mad.
Right, exactly.
They're always up to some devilment. It just never ends. It never ends.
That's right.
But what I do want to share is that, interestingly, I was out, and I had some stuff I had to do, and I was talking with a brother while I was out from Nigeria, and he's from the Igbo tribe.
Okay.
And he was telling me how the Igbos were the, and he's probably in his 50s or something like that. He was telling me how, a little bit about the history of the Igbos and how they are the only tribe in West Africa that wasn't infected and poisoned by Europeans and their invasion, because they refused to acquiesce, to do, you know, to come under their power. And they refused everything. So they maintained their culture, and then those that were captured, they refused to be enslaved. And so most, he said all, and I'll say most all, jumped overboard when they were on the ships. They decided to go to the world of the ancestors rather than to be enslaved and under the control of these lunatics. So he was teaching me about a tribe that practiced resistance from day one, and very effectively, because again, they still maintain their culture. So those things that were talked about earlier about how and the questions that were asked about how Africans do it, the Igbos have some answers.
Okay, right.
And so I was asking him about, you know, what, how the history was passed down. How could I learn this information? Because I was assuming that there were no books written, because a lot of African history from the Africans are through griots, oral history. And he said, oh, no, there are books that are written, but everybody can't have access because of the Europeans, you know, pattern of stealing everything.
Right.
And tampering with everything. So sounds like the Igbos to me are people that were very effective.
Right. They have a rich history. Very rich history.
Yeah, and see, that's a history I don't know of. And so the brother's going to get me some books. He's going to get me some books.
Mm-hmm.
And he was confirming what I firmly believe. As I talked to Ghanaians and Togolese and, you know, people from various parts of Africa, that we need to learn more from the African themselves.
Mm-hmm.
We must develop relationship with our brothers, our continental African brothers and sisters, because they have a lot to teach us.
Okay.
And that is through relationship for me. Your scholarship, Dr. Rogers, is just, oh, God. I mean, I could sit and learn from you all day. But for me, since I'm not a scholar, not a historian, I've learned a significant amount of about our culture and African ways, you know, through the centuries from Africans.
Exactly. That's good. So that's true.
That education through relationship,
right,
and building relationships and building trust, I've gotten some really, really good education. So I just want to emphasize that we need to, I would say there's a significant amount of elitism among our scholars born here, and that we can move past, and that doesn't include you, not you, but we need to move past that and listen, let our African brothers and sisters teach us.
I agree. And that's what Brother White was saying. He was saying that, what can we learn from them? We need, you know, just like you said, you learn from that.
And I want to emphasize this through relationship, because that's what that the European was very successful, as we all know, at dividing us.
Right, they are. No doubt about it. No doubt about
it. Yeah, but there's there are efforts to reconnect now. So let's get on board and reconnect.
I love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've got about 15 more minutes. I want to talk a little bit about, this is very important. I remember once in one of my classes, we were talking in African history, and this European, young European male raised his hand, and he said to me, I appreciate, all of the greatness and things that you were talking about Africa, but if they were so great, why did they fall? What happened? You know, what did they do wrong? I said, well, just for the sake of that to answer him quickly, I said, same thing that happened to Rome, same thing that happened to Greece, the same thing that happened to England, the same thing that's going to happen to America. It's the same thing, you know, so that it falls. But clearly also, from a scholar's point of view, and for us as a community, there are some things about that whole Africa falling that we need to just kind of mention, and I want to talk a little bit about it in the last 15 minutes that we have together. As you know, Dr. Chancellor Williams did the definitive work on the destruction of the African civilization. He's done a lot of things from that. But there's some things that I think we need to take in consideration and look at it from another reference point. So as it comes to the whole idea of the fall of Africa, many of our scholars say that one must realize that Africa didn't fall. That's not what happened. Because Africa was separate empires. They were empires all over that piece of land that we have labeled as Africa. There were other states, there were other nations, other ethnic groups, like you said. There were the Hausa, there were the Igbo. The Igbo didn't fall, as your sister Yan said. They didn't fall. The Yoruba, they still did what they did and practiced their religion. So eventually, a lot of them, however, were colonized and conquered in the more modern era. And their land was taken from them, but there are reasons how that was able to happen. And it was not because they failed. So then mostly the thing I think we have to understand in geographically is that Africa was not a central system. It didn't fall because of the fact that people were defeated. The Asante, the Zulus, they weren't defeated. The Hausa states or the Sudan, not like that. They didn't fall. As we said, there was no capital of Africa, so there wasn't like that was conquered, or there was no central government in the continent of Africa, and a lot of the Africans didn't see Africa as a united piece. It was geography. It was just a piece of land that folks happened to label Africa. It would not be until the Pan-African movement began to emerge, that Africans began to view it as a holistic system. The rise of Pan-Africanism is really brought African people to begin to see and define themselves in that way. And to Europe, that was an advantage. That helped Europe out. So when you did that, that gave them something to look at how to take and conquest and how to colonize and go in there. And so when you see the Berlin Conference, and look at that whole system of the Berlin Conference, they went in to colonize that continent, and they looked at it continentally. But prior to that, Africans didn't see themselves in a continental way. So I think the key is that we have to look at rephrasing. Like I say, a lot of times we ask the wrong question. And so the question is, not why did Africa fall, but rather what factors led to Europe's temporary conquest and the colonization of African societies. What did that? And that's what Chancellor Williams wrote about in the destruction of the African civilization. He wrote about some of those specific factors that went into place. And I just want to mention a few. Can't get into all of them. And another one that you can add that wasn't a part of it was the technology. That's not how that happened. One would first say that Europe had superior technological advantage. It is important, however, to note that Europe at first did not have serious technological advantage over Africa. They had not able to do that, especially during the Moors. The Moors had to go to them and teach them how to technologically do things, particularly in Spain and Portugal. And so by the end of the 1400s, Africans were running Europe. And Walter Rodney talks about that in detail. And he says, Walter Rodney says that in the 15th century, European technology was not totally superior to that of other parts of the world, never mind Africa. And in fact, Europeans imported a lot of African and Asian clothes and other consumer goods during this period. So in terms of Europe's eventual technological advance, it is also important to recognize that it was not simply the gun either, which gave Europe the advantage for Africans and Asians, because a lot of Africans and Asians had weapons too, so it wasn't just that. So then the question is, what is important to recognize is the complexity of the factors of which the gun was used and how it was used, and its central factor, not only in just shooting, but it was used as a source of trading. I could trade you some guns for 100 people, and looking at how that was done. And so that doing that eventually gave them a technological advantage over Africa. So, yes, one was the guns. The gun did help tremendously. In terms of cutting deals and being able to do things, it was more important to the Africans than gold. Africans didn't need gold. That wasn't something. The only thing the Africans used the gold for was to trade with Europe. The guns, and then maritime science, the creation of long-distance ships and boats. Now, Africans had a maritime science too. That was very sufficient. It was how they were able to get to the Americas prior to the Europeans did. But they began to master the ships and creating those huge sails and those masts and able to harness and use the wind as a force of trading. And so the Vikings, for instance, and then eventually the Dutch. The Dutch got into the shipbuilding business. And they created masterful ships that were able to go over a long distance of time and travel. This helped also tremendously. And then using capitalism as a system of production, that did it. And the whole system of how capitalism works and control of the production of goods and the distribution of goods under this system. And again, Dr. Walter Rodney talks about that tremendously in his book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And he talked about the creation of all of that. The rise of European hegemony and all of this came about as it began to master some of these areas that I discussed. And so the Muslims, the Africans, and all the others began to fall under the power of that. So the gun and the monopoly on it gave Europeans the capacity to impose their will on people. Ships gave them the capacity to collect and synthesize technique and to seize goods and to seize human beings like they did on some of those slave ships. If you've ever seen one of those slave ships, they were nightmares to our people, but they were masterful mechanisms of long-distance travel and able how to do that. So thus, by the time the colonial era comes in around 1800, Europe was able to conquer cities, states, and empires through their force of arms. They were able to dictate political developments in Africa. The forced abandonment of productive processes like clothing manufacturing and iron smelting, and therefore eventually encouraged the loss of technique and scientific inquiry necessary for technological advancement. And that's what they killed in Africa. That was the enemy. They stopped the production of African being able to do that, not only just through those methods, but by taking most of its people, uprooting their people out of the land and taking them to a foreign area and leaving those areas depleted of manpower. That's how it was done. That's how the Africans were able to be conquered. So don't be making people make these statements that they were weak and they didn't know how to use tools. That is clearly a misnomer, and that we have to look at that in terms of our teaching. And as because even our young people, I've had young African American students say, "Well, Mr. Dr. Rogers, how come they lost all that?" You know, so we have to be prepared to explain that in a way that helps them to understand. Now, a second factor which increased Europe's ability to conquer and impose its will on Africa was its economic advantage. It said, in fact, its ships began to become a part of the military structures of things. They were using these ships to fight wars. There was a whole design that some of the ships at one point in time held guns on one side of the ship. So they would have three guns, and so they would fight using that. And then people began to, particularly in the wars between Spain and England, the Spanish and the pirates learned to attack the Spanish ships on the side that didn't have guns. So they would set up a V in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And so when those Spanish ships would come out of Africa, coming back to Europe, they would attack them from the side that didn't have guns. And so the ships then had to become a little bit stronger, and they had to put guns on both sides. So they would be able to fight that. That created a problem, because that made the ships heavy, and a lot of the treasury that they had conquered would begin to sink. So that's why people were in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean looking for sunken treasure, because a lot of those ships sunk on their way up the Atlantic, going back to Europe, because they were too heavy. They had to put those guns on there to fight each other in doing that. So it also enhanced their war mentality of Europe. Europe became ruthless because it was attempting to survive in that process of fighting those countries that were trying to uproot that African trade and do some of the things that they were doing. So the Portuguese, the Spanish, the Dutch, the English, the French, all were at each other. They were warring nations. That's why when you look at those forts, along the coast of West Africa, those forts were a part of that. So that's what I wanted you to think about in terms of looking at fallen factors about Africa falling. It didn't fall. It was just a matter of circumstance of how things were going. I heard someone say long time ago at a lecture, he said Africa's sin or Africa's enemy was its own resources. Because it created a quest and a greed and a desire for the whole world to come after it. And so that's what made it fall. And I just wanted to add to that, this is a subject that's ongoing. We may talk about this again someday. We thank you all for being with us tonight. This has been a wonderful conversation. We thank our listening audience that we're online. We thank those of you who made your contributions here to some of the things we were going to say. Next week, we'll be back with another program. Right after this show is the Warren Valentine Show. It comes on at 9 o'clock, so we recommend all of you to see that. Listen to that if you can. And you can always go to our archive and listen to any of the recordings that we've had. Thank you so much. Have a great week. We appreciate your participation and your patronage. Thank you.